What's up, guys? Doug Polk here, and welcome back for another episode of the Doug Polk Podcast. Today, we are joined by upswing coach Gary Blackwood, otherwise known as Gazzy B, will be joining us to talk about the state of poker in 2022. We're going to talk a little bit about the Hellmuth hand. Of course, you got to talk a bit of Hellmuth after this Queen 4 situation. Then we're going to talk about sort of where poker is at today, and we have a few hand histories we're going to be breaking down from a recent high-stakes poker episode, all of this and more, and we're going to be, of course, concluding with, have I mentioned my personal life? I'm going to talk about tornadoes in Texas, so a full podcast coming your way. Before we jump into those, I want to let you guys know, last week we finalized our list, top five poker players ever, in case you missed it. Who won might surprise you. Actually, it probably won't, so you can check that out last week over my podcast. All right. Now, a brief word from our sponsor. Today's podcast is brought to you by CoinFlex. CoinFlex is a cryptocurrency derivatives exchange and is the home of crypto yield for people to both trade and earn crypto. We have exciting news to share today. CoinFlex is coming to the U.S. with CoinFlex.us, the only place in America where you can earn interest every 8 hours with FlexUSD. FlexUSD is a revolutionary stablecoin that's fully backed, independently verified, and pays interest every 8 hours. No staking or lockups required. You can convert FlexUSD one-to-one with US dollars at any time and start earning wherever you hold it. Whether in your CoinFlex.us wallet, your MetaMask, or even in cold storage, you'll still be getting paid every 8 hours. To celebrate the launch, CoinFlex.us is giving away $100,000 for the lodge. Will begin on, I want to say, May 4th. We're going to have over $5 million in guarantees. Actually, we have exactly $5 million in guarantees. Over 15 events and a $2 million main event with a $3,000 buy-in. So stay tuned for more poker coming at you from Texas Poker. And one last note, Upswing Poker has a new course announcement this week. Stay tuned, guys. You don't want to miss this announcement later this week. Okay, on that note, let's go ahead and bring in today's guest, Gazzy B. Welcome to the pod, man.
Thanks very much. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you just fine. I had to lower my volume because I think we probably did a little too high on the volume level on that ad read out of the gate. But yeah, you sound good.
Sounded good to me. Thanks for having me on. Very excited to be here.
Cool. No, thanks for joining us. So a lot to talk about today. We're going to keep this very poker focused. And I want to kick this off with talking about the recent Phil Hellmuth Queen 4 offsuit hand. Guys, did you get a chance to check that one out?
I've seen it. I've seen it. He's a whale. Next question.
Oh, okay. So we're gonna just call him.
No. Not at all. But yeah,
we actually already had the social media accounts. Gazzy B, he's a whale at Phil Hellmuth.
it's a fun hand for sure. Everyone's been having a lot of fun with it. Well, what do you think about it yourself? Any thoughts on it?
Well, so I guess the elephant in the room is that he didn't look at his cards, right? He looked at one card and then made the move, supposedly. Okay. So the question is, should you ever do that? I'm going to say no.
I'm going to say no as well. Yeah, it seems like a bit of an ICM punt, as the tournament guys would say, to be honest with you. I mean, if you're Phil Hellmuth, you could do with three cards, never mind looking at just one compared to some of the guys he's playing against. So it seems like a bit of a mistake to just look at one card and make a decision.
Definitely agree with that. I will say that it's a spot where if you're in Foxen's shoes, so for those of you that aren't familiar with the hand or the final table of a tournament, Foxen opens the button, Foxen's the big stack, and Phil Hellmuth has, I'm going to say 17-ish blinds, 16 blinds, three bets, queen four offsuit to what is seven big blinds here, so almost half the stack, and then action gets back to Foxen. It's one of those situations that as a tournament player, you have so many flashbacks of, oh my God, this guy has aces. It does scream that. So the play itself is quite scary.
Uh-huh.
But then also you have queen four offsuit. Can't we pick basically anything better than this?
I completely agree. I mean, if we're three betting queen four offsuit, we're three betting like, 40, 50% of our range, something like that. And it's obviously just way too wide. We want to choose hands that have better playability. Post flop, look for hands like queen jack suited, king ten suited, even hands like king jack offsuit and stuff like that. Much rather have two big cards or something like ace four suited. I know the tournament guys that like their ace eight offsuit and stuff like that in this position, but queen four off, I mean, just fold and move on to the next hand. I mean, three betting it is bad enough, but then calling off, I mean, come on. 16 big straight in the bin.
How are you splitting your range pre-flop? Because on something like a 20, 25, 30 big blind stack, you're probably going to have an all-in range, and you're also going to have a small three-bet range, right? And you're going to be splitting up between both of those. Is at what stack size are we no longer splitting and we're just playing basically jam or call? Or we're probably right around there with 16, I would imagine.
I think that's about right. About 16 bigs, we kind of have a three-bet range now. I mean, I'm not a tournament guy by any stretch of the imagination. I've played a fair few tournaments in my time, but I think around about 16, 17 bigs is sort of the cutoff point. 13, 14, I don't have a three-bet range. It's just all in or call or fold. But around about 16, I think you can split between shove and small three bet, but queen four off doesn't make it into either of those for me anyway.
Right. We're thinking big picture here, guys. Just imagine you only know one card. Okay. I guess that's enough of the queen four off suit. Just a couple general Phil Hellmuth notes here before we jump in and start talking about poker in today's day and age.
Yeah.
I have to say that I felt fairly vindicated when I had made some of the comments about Phil earlier that week. And then the queen four off suit happens because it does seem like this stuff happens to Phil time and time again, where he makes the play that you should never make. It doesn't work out, but then he manages to hit whatever cards are necessary. So what do you think? Phil Hellmuth, luckiest of all time?
Absolutely, yeah. I think he's a very overrated poker player. I think his antics are disgraceful in all seriousness. I'm really not a big Phil Hellmuth fan. Got a lot of respect for him. Obviously, he does really well in these, you know, WSOP events, you know, these like 200, 300 Raz fields, etc. He's obviously very good at these sort of fields, but when it comes to no limit hold'em, he's just not a good poker player. He makes some very strange plays. Don't know if you've seen the heads up duel where he's doing things like, you know, limp folding ace queen or whatever it was. You know, he makes some very great ace jack suited. That's exactly it. And everyone's like, oh, you know, Negreanu had better. It's such a great play. But if Negreanu's sitting there with ace ten offsuit, like he is 90% of the time with other hands that are not as good as ace jack suited, it's just a really poor play. But I think you're absolutely right. He does seem to run quite well and make some poor plays and get rewarded.
What makes you use the word disgraceful?
Just the things that he says at the poker table, and he gets away with it because he's Phil Hellmuth. I mean, he makes that queen four offsuit play, and then 20 hands later, he's all in with ace queen versus ace jack, completely standard, and he loses, and he's up on his feet, this fucking guy, and F-bombs and this, that, and that. And if it was anyone, if it was me, they'd kick me out of the fucking building, I wouldn't be invited back. But because it's Phil Hellmuth, and he gets away with it, and it's just, I just think it's all a big charade, and it's, you know, it's all for the cameras and stuff like that. And it's just, he's what, you know, in his mid 40s, late 40s, something like that. He's a grown man, you know, he can't
I think he's a little older than that. I think he's in his mid 50s.
Even worse then, you know.
We probably need to get an age verification. The best example of that kind of behavior from Phil, I think, is the I'm going to burn this place fucking down incident at the Rio last summer. I've talked about this a little bit on this podcast before, but just to kind of highlight it, if you have not seen Phil in all his glory at that final table from last year, that you need to go check this out, because we're all kind of used to these sort of outbursts from Phil, but it was basically just several hours straight of yelling, cursing, complaining. I never counted the number of fucks. If I had to set the line, I would say 200 is probably a fairly safe line.
It's a good line.
I think it's a good line. And then there was throwing cards. There was just sort of an outrageous number of things that just even before saying, I'm going to burn this place fucking down. Mm-hmm. And then once you add in that he says that, what number of players can say that at a final table and they're not going to have a penalty, the floor called, some kind of, you know, action taken against them because they're saying something like that? Kind of ridiculous. And I think disgraceful is just a great word to sum it up.
Yeah, I think people love it because, oh, you know, it's Phil Hellmuth and all that jazz. But I mean, at the end of the day, it's, you know, it's just, it's really disgraceful and tactless, and just, it shouldn't be allowed. And, you know, you ask the question of how many people can do that, and the answer is one. It's Phil Hellmuth and Phil Hellmuth only. And it shouldn't be allowed. The F-bombs are bad enough, but, you know, threatening to burn the place to ground. I can't remember who the older gentleman was at that final table. He's a legend of the game. I think he did a lot at the Bellagio with their tournament series, etc. And this old guy in his, like, 70s or 80s is just looking at Phil Hellmuth like, what are you doing? And he's just like, F-bombs and this, that, and throwing cards. And it's just like, come on. Man, just play the game, just play with a bit of class, you know. It's like he's a multimillionaire, the money doesn't matter to him that much, you know. It's just, it's really poor taste in my opinion. Shouldn't be allowed.
Yeah, I think that the there is a couple aspects to this, right? First off is, when you're successful, you shouldn't be as tilted by these pots. I say that, but then every time I get stacked at 5-10 at the lodge, I die inside. So maybe I can't say that as much anymore.
Happens quite a lot from what I've seen.
It does happen quite a lot. Thank you for the reminder. But I guess the other side to this is that Phil is a very passionate player, and a lot of people talk about, oh, well, they think that's just an act on TV. That's not an act. This is who Phil is. This is how he behaves. He really cares a lot. So I can certainly tell you, for the negative things about Phil, he is absolutely genuine. This is who he is. And, you know, it can have its moments where it's quite in quite poor form, but at least he's not putting on some fake show just to kind of, you know, get people all rowdy.
I'm really surprised at that. I was under the impression it was all fake and that he was just pretending to be as annoyed as he is. I'll obviously take your word for it. Obviously, you know him a lot better than I do, but I'm really quite surprised at that. I thought it was just one big show for the cameras, to be honest.
No, this is who Phil is. Actually, you know what? Taking a step back, basically all of the big names in poker, that's who they are away from the table.
Really?
Almost no one puts on an act, yeah. Wow. Basically no one. My experience with almost all these guys, I can't even really think of someone that is different away from the table.
So you think everyone is the way they are at the tables and away from the tables as well?
Yeah, I think so. And there's so many conspiracy theorist people that think, oh, they're just trying to get the views and turn this into this, and they know that people will get angry at them, or this, they're stirring up some beef, or this guy's trying to tilt people. But when I see people on TV and then I see what they're like in more personal settings, I find by far and away they're exactly the same. I'd have to think of an example of someone that is specifically different, but nothing even comes to mind. Wow. Out of gate.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's quite interesting to know. I thought a few of these guys would be putting on a show for the cameras, especially Phil, but it's pretty cool to hear that they're the same as they are away from the tables as they are on it.
Well, I think Phil's sort of generation of players, mm-hmm. a lot of those guys, they built their name by sort of, they built their brand because they were the outspoken mm-hmm. people that are kind of over the top. You know, you think about guys like Daniel Negreanu. I guess you definitely don't think about Phil Ivey. Would it surprise you that Phil Ivey is that quiet away from the table?
No, I think that sounds about right, to be honest.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I think for a lot of these guys, they built their name up because they were able to market themselves well during that era. But it's kind of difficult when you have a long stream. Let's say you're on stream for 6 hours or something, mm-hmm. or how many streams are these guys going to do a year? It's kind of different to always be putting on act. At some point, I think you just get used to it. And maybe there's a blending there. Maybe that their poker personality and who they really are kind of merge into one, and they're always that thing. I don't know. But I don't see a lot of difference away from the table.
Wow, that's pretty cool. What about Mike Matisai? Is he just as awful as he is away from the tables as he is on it?
You know, I think that Mike isn't as bad at the table as he is on Twitter.
Oh, yeah. That's
There seems to be a bit of a drop off there. And Mike came on this podcast last year and we talked a little bit, and we were talking about some of his COVID takes and some political stuff a little bit, you know, because we want to get the viewers all angry. Anyway, we were talking about a few of those things, and I was thinking, man, these are some very reasonable, well, you know, not reasonably well thought out takes that are fairly neutral. And then I'll just see a tweet and I'm just like, what the hell is this? It's like that. So I don't know if there's a disconnect between Twitter there or not, but I would say at like a TV table versus in person, I would say Mike is also pretty consistent with that. But I've played less with Mike than I have the other guys.
Okay, that's pretty cool. Pretty good to know.
Okay, let's put the Phil Hellmuth subject behind us. Let's move into talking about poker in 2022. And so I feel like for me, I went through a fairly long gap where I played almost no poker, and you can debate if playing live 5-10 is poker still. But I went through quite a phase where I did not play much poker in a ring setting, certainly not much online. And I'm seeing kind of how people play a little bit today, but I don't really feel like I have my finger on the pulse like someone like you does, where you have played a lot online consistently for years now. You played some live as well, so you've kind of seen both things. How have you seen the game shift over the last few years in terms of poker strategy?
Well, let's talk a little bit about online first. Obviously, online and live, two completely different scenarios. Online, you know, it goes without saying, online has evolved so much. We're now in what we call the solver era. Things are completely different to how they were, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. I've actually been thinking about this a lot yesterday and today. It was 8 years ago yesterday I went full-time as a professional poker player, and I was thinking about how poker was different back then in general, and for me as well, compared to how it is today. You know, and, you know, the general landscape of poker, you know, you could break even / lose slightly and still make six figures a year due to all the rakeback rewards, etc. Obviously, poker is a lot different in this day and age, But I just want to quickly address something that you read a lot online about, you know, online poker. It's really difficult to beat. It's impossible. There are bot rings and collusion and X, Y, and Z. I'm of the opinion that poker is still very much booming and very comfortable to beat. I mean, I play mid-stakes personally up to 10, 20 no limit online. And sure, you've got to approach the game a lot more differently in this day and age, and you've got to, you know, study a lot harder and a lot more effectively as well. But to all these doom and gloom merchants out there that are saying that poker is no longer beatable, I just don't see it. There's always going to be recreational players that play online. Sure, there are going to be, you know, people that are doing unethical things like using real-time assistants or, you know, colluding, etc. But the number of people that are doing that is nowhere near as much as people think. A lot of people think, you know, you sit at a table with three Russian guys, they're all cheating or using assistants. It's just not the case. There are always recreational players. There are always bad regs out there. So as long as you approach the game in a professional manner and you study effectively, in order to beat 5, 10, 10, 20, etc., it's mandatory to use a solver and use the solver well. But I certainly don't think that poker is dying or anywhere near close to it. And it's, you know, it's really sad to read that online because it's people who are just telling themselves that because they can no longer beat the game, if that makes sense. Whereas you've got, you know, plenty of players out there that still study, still work really hard and still make lots of money. It's still a very comfortable living if you approach it in the right way.
There's a couple of different aspects to this. You're going to have the people that lose and blame things. Always, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't surprise me that you blame it on cheating and those types of things. It reminds me a little bit of the people, obviously this is a step above that, but who think that it's rigged and that the cards come out. It's obviously a little bit different than that because it's plausible to argue the first thing rather than that. But regardless, it's just a lack of taking responsibility for your own shortcomings and try to improve yourself. Mm-hmm. But it is undeniable that the games have gotten tougher. And when you say something like, you know, 5, 10, 10, 20, you can't be without a solver today. Well, I mean, I think that that's fairly obvious given where poker is. But even at the start of your career back in 2014, there wasn't publicly available solvers in 2014. So you could definitely beat 5, 10, 10, 20 without them. So my counterpoint would be, okay, maybe that's true. But even through just the arc of your career, those same games were beatable without those tools 8 years ago, and now they're just mandatory.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's down to the evolution of the game. Obviously, you know, 6, 7, 8 years ago, as you said, everyone was terrible and nobody knew that they were terrible. They all thought they were pretty good. And even the good regs in the grand scheme of things were terrible. They played nothing close to how good the best regs are today. So it's just a complete evolution of poker.
Right. But that evolution of poker leaves you as someone that's maybe a mediocre reg. You go from being a winning player to a losing player. So I guess like we could think about it like it's certainly not you can't make a living anymore. You can't make money playing poker online, but the level has changed and now you have to be operating at a higher level. What's your thoughts on the skill sets that's required? I've talked a little bit about this in the past, but basically I think poker used to be a lot more about problem solving and coming up with your own sort of theories as to the way things work, right? Because in 2013, 14, or 10 or before, there wasn't something you could just consult and this is the answer for what you should be doing. You had to come up with ideas of your own and try to solve problems. Mm-hmm. But now it's not like that. Right now it's we know sort of the general ideas that are at play in all these situations, and we need to make sure that we're finding the right, basically the right hands to do the right things, the right frequencies. How has the skill set required to be good changed over just your career?
One thing I want to quickly address is what you just said about going from being a winning reg to, you know, a break even or losing reg. That's exactly what happened to me. The solvers came out, you know, all my peers were studying, etc. I was a little arrogant. I said, you know, I didn't need to use this. And I sort of fell behind. And it was only really in 2017, 2018 that I caught back up again. But with regards to the evolution of poker, as you say, you know, in terms of the skill set that's required, 8 years ago, I was playing 150,000 hands a month of 50 NL, and I was, you know, making all these rewards, et cetera, slightly break even, slightly losing. But nowadays, you have to be at the top of your field, and it's all down to studying well and studying effectively. You know, I've mentioned the word solver a few times, and, you know, probably everyone that's watching this is capable of using a solver, but there's a way to use it to the most, to get the most out of it, essentially. And I feel like, you know, that is one of the most important skill sets in this day and age, is not only studying, but studying really effectively and getting the most out of your solver in terms of, you know, looking for trends within the solver. And, you know, as opposed to studying a hand, you solve a spot and you apply it to several different positions and you increase your EV in those positions. And then you come back to it and really fine tune your strategy. For example, you can study, you know, small blind versus button and small blind versus cutoff and play it relatively similarly. And you keep your, you know, your, your strategy like that, and then you go and solve the different spot, and then you come back to that and say, well, actually, small members of cutoff, I've got to play a little more differently, and I've got to do a little more, you know, a little less c-betting on these types of textures, etc. But studying effectively is by far the most important tool to a modern poker player, in my opinion.
Definitely, and I see that from many people when they say, okay, I want to get better, I want to spend the time, but how do I actually do that?
Yeah.
And so I guess let me forward that on to you. What do you think is the way to study effectively in today's day and age?
Well, I want to very quickly talk about... So I want to quickly talk about what we just said. For anyone that's watching this and is not yet using a solver, I was once where you were. It's really overwhelming at first. It's really horrible. And I gave up, you know, 7-8 times before I started to use it effectively. To get the most out of your solver, you don't solve a hand, you solve a spot. So, you know, in Pio Solver, I only use Pio. I don't use G2 Wizard or anything like that. But you run, you know, 400 flops and you run they're called aggregate reports, and it lists every flop and it tells you the highest EV option on Queen 7 deuce, Queen 7 3, Queen 7 4. And you look for trends within the solver. My strategy is very simplified, and I play, you know, my single Broadway is the same, my double Broadway is the same, my paired board is the same, and so on and so forth. So you look for trends within the solver, you look for the highest bet size, you look for the frequency that you should be checking back as a preflop aggressor, and then you just apply that. It's as simple as that. You look for the trends, you know, you spot the trends and you apply it to your game. It's really as simple as that. I remember the first time I ever used a solver, I ran a sim for Queen 7 deuce. And I put it in my spreadsheet, and then I ran the sim for Queen 7-3. And, you know, I was spending like 30 minutes per hand. Then I learned to run these aggregate reports, and it's like, okay, I've increased my EV in this spot overall in an hour. Simple as that. It's, you know, it's really daunting at first, but it's really quite easy when you get the hand.
And how much difference are you even getting when you look at Queen 7-3 versus Queen 7-2? So there's really almost...
It's minimal, yeah. But you get these anomalies, like, you know, there can be a time where Queen 7-3 is played really differently to Queen 7-2, but Queen 7-4 is back to Queen 7-2. So you're not looking for these anomalies. Like, I'll play Queen 7-2, 3 and 4 the exact same. We're not looking for these anomalies. We're just looking for a trend within the solver.
Yeah, so when I played my heads up challenge and I was going through all this stuff, I basically got down to optimal single size flop strategy for basically every board. Mm-hmm. And then I grouped them, and then I looked for certain characteristics that put them into buckets. And then I had something like 30 different bucketed kinds of flops. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, ace high boards where there was no deuce to six, the optimal single size on the flop was tremendously different than when there was a deuce to six. Yeah. So, you know, in the deuce to six example, I might have an 80% flop C bet frequency with a 1/3 pot size, but in the seven, let's say the when there's no deuce to six, I mean like ace jack seven, it really, if you're going to use single size flop strats, it really liked huge sizes. It liked 125% on the flop, but you use like a 30% c-bet frequency or something
exactly,
like that.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so you basically just bucket all of these boards into different groups once you have those aggregate reports, and then you can sort of fine tune your strategy in each one of those classes by looking at how should I be playing these given the size I'm going to be. So I know that the size is roughly optimal for this bucket.
Yeah.
Now I want to look at some sims using the size. Mm-hmm. What do I see in terms of, you know, what within that bucket, within that branch, let me take two boards that are the most different, right? So maybe take a board like King, Queen, Eight versus Ace, Jack, Seven or something like that. And then how are they different on these boards, and how's the frequency change? How does turn barrel change? All that kind of stuff. So I guess the thing is, that process is going to take time, right? There's no way around that.
That's exactly it. Yeah. I mean, it certainly takes a lot of time. You know, it's with anything. It's, you know, particularly with a complex game like poker, you're absolutely right. It's going to take a lot of time, and there's going to be a lot of, you know, studying and, you know, making notes, etc. I just want to quickly say, and not to plug Upswing on myself too much, but I've made three modules for Upswing now. And the second module is all about, you know, big blind raising button C bets and raising MP C bets. And I'm really proud of that module, because a lot of what we've just talked about is in that module. So if there's anyone out there that is looking to get better at studying, I'd strongly recommend that second module. And I've got these spreadsheets that are available for students to download, et cetera. And it's like a cheat sheet. It just puts everything on a plate. And, you know, you look at that, and it's very clearly laid out what boards you should be betting 1/3 on, what boards you should be betting half on, 75%, and so on and so forth. But these, you know, these spreadsheets, they've changed my game, and they're really helpful. But once you start to analyze the data in groups as opposed to single hands, as we've said, but it just becomes very easy, which is great.
Yeah, that's certainly the best way to approach it, and it seems like a very useful resource for people, in my totally unbiased opinion. So what do you do with this? Because it's something that kind of came across in my study a lot. I would look at a sim and I would start to see some hands in there that felt just really terrible as raises. And I want to give you the best example. Mm-hmm. Solvers seem to do, at least in heads up ranges, let's just say three bet pots, right? You call a three bet and the flop is something like Jack-8-7 or Jack-8-6, something like that.
Yeah.
I'll say Jack-8-6 for this example. And they see a bet. And solvers love raising Ace-8 there a good mm-hmm. chunk of the time.
Yeah.
And that just feels so, so awful.
Yeah.
It feels so awful because yeah. what do you do versus small three bet? Probably call.
Yeah.
What do you do versus a larger three bet? It's unclear. And so what do you do when you get some of these solver results where you look at it and you say, okay, I believe it, but now I have to play my hand in just such a garbage way from here. Like, how do you take those situations where you don't like the output and then apply it into your game and feel good about it?
I think that's a great question. And one thing that we can talk about is, you know, the solver plays against the solver. So the example you've just given, the ace-8, you know, it's going to play optimally versus that three bet. Whereas in reality, your opponent, if it's Daniel Negreanu, he's not going to three bet anywhere near as much as the solver does. So my approach to that is I take those more uncomfortable marginal situations out, and I'll just increase my frequency with other hands, like, you know, my top pairs, for example, like my ace jacks and my king jacks. Instead of doing exactly what the solver says with these, I'll just increase the frequency with those a little bit, or some slightly higher equity hands, like on that example, you know, we'll have a queen 10 and stuff like that. So those uncomfortable ones that I'm not really sure how to play versus three bets or play on the turn, etc., just remove them, or, you know, make them really low frequency and increase your frequency elsewhere with hands that you are comfortable playing. For example, raising king jack and queen 10 and stuff like that on that example.
So I found myself, so I used to be a very much exploit based player.
Yeah.
Coming up in the heads up streets, you kind of had to be, there wasn't much mm-hmm. publicly available stuff. I would look at my entire sample of hands. I would see what's gone well, see what's gone badly. I would use that as my pre-flop threshold to what I'm calling. You know, I was actually, one of the things that I found playing heads up that I was pretty happy to see is, for basically years, I didn't think you could defend the weakest ace-x off versus three bet and heads up for years. Okay. Right. And everyone told me I was an idiot. And so I just see all these guys fighting ace-x all over the place. And then finally we get some range. It's like, oh, look at that. You can't call ace-4 off versus a three bet. Anyway.
Human solver right here.
Yeah. Trust me, there were things I was doing plenty wrong. but that was how I basically got to the bottom of what I should be doing. Was I would look at my database and then I would try and create a baseline from there, and then I would adjust to people, right? Like if you play someone mm-hmm. they like just don't see it at the flop enough, you could probably get away with stuff like that, right?
Yeah.
So I had to go through this shift from I'm more like kind of I have a good baseline, but I'm really gonna figure out what you're doing, exploit you, to now I have solvers. And one thing that I really struggled with when I played recently was I found that I stopped the I'm going to adjust here thing, because I just knew if I just play these ranges I will win.
Yeah.
And there's a comfort, there's a comforting aspect of just winning. Can you do that same approach in six max though, or is that something that you really kind of have to just apply for heads up?
No, absolutely you can. I mean you can play with solver-based foundation in terms of your strategy. You can play relatively similar to the solver and make as many exploits as you want. I'm not the best guy in terms of, you know, looking at my hold'em manager or my poker tracker and making assumptions from the player pool. I'm very much, I try and replicate the solver as best as I can and have my own reasons for that. But there are obviously some situations where we will deviate slightly. There's a friend of mine, Cameron, who has a fantastic phrase, and it's, just play unexploitably and watch the EV come your way. And it's such a true phrase. Like if you just learn what the solver is doing and try and replicate that, as you've just said, you know, that's a foolproof strategy essentially. But I do think there are situations, you know, particularly for the guys that are playing lower stakes, you know, people watching this playing 15L, 100L, et cetera, you want a lot of deviation in that strategy. You don't want to play just as the solver does, because that can be quite detrimental. But slightly higher stakes, you know, 500, 1K, 2K, et cetera, I think a much more solver-based strategy is the way to go for sure.
Makes sense. We've talked a lot about online.
Yeah.
How much live have you played?
In my lifetime, quite a lot. Spent a lot of time in America. I've been to the series for, you know, 4 or 5 years in a row now. I spent a lot of time in LA, going back to LA in a few weeks, really excited about that. I'm leaving for America on the 20th of April, and I'm going to be gone for 3 months, just pure live poker. It's going to be a lot of fun. But overall, yeah, I played a fair share, played a decent amount.
So what are some changes you've seen in live poker? I guess the thing with live is it's always going to be so lineup dependent, but have you seen any kind of general shifts in the strategy today versus 3, 4, or 5 years ago?
Well, I didn't play any live poker in the UK. I live in London, and a couple of years ago, live poker in London, everyone was really quite poor. And I hadn't played over the pandemic, and things are a lot tougher now. I played over the last couple of months, and obviously the games are still really quite soft, but a little tougher than they used to be. In terms of poker, your side of the pond, it's with all due respect, it's still relatively soft. I haven't seen, a significant increase in the quality of poker player in America. I think, as you get higher, the good regs become really good, 5, 10, 10, 20, et cetera. But, the 1, 2, 1, 3, 2, 5, a lot of 5, 10, it's still a gold mine, essentially. It's still really, really soft, and there's a lot of money to be made. That doesn't mean that anyone watching this who plays these games shouldn't be studying their asses off and doing their utmost to increase their EV, but still a lot of fun, a lot of money to be made, and I'm really looking forward to getting back out.
So, American players here on the podcast, you can feel personally attacked by Gazzy B. It's soft in your games because of you.
It's compliment because you guys have got lots of disposable income, and
look at our role models here, Gazzy. We look up to Phil Hellmuth. What are you supposed to do?
I can't wait to get in there and see everyone 3-betting the Queen 4 offsuit, making a fucking call.
Add that to your ranges. I like that Phil Hellmuth tweeted the image where he had that selected in the poker range. That was a good laugh.
And he can laugh at himself. I like that about him. He can sort of take it in his stride a little bit.
Part of the thing for me is I can't tell how much of live poker is changing because people are just coming after me in spots versus if it's actually some genuine changes in strategy. But it at least feels like people have a little bit better idea of what's going on today than they did back before.
Yeah. I think there's always going to be a slow and steady increase. But, compared to online where it's gone like this, I think it's a much slower, much steadier increase. Live poker, there's a lot of money to be made for sure.
Yeah. Yep. All right. So we have coming up for you guys some hand histories from High Stakes Poker. We're going to break down. We're going to talk about a few of the best ones. We're going to break those hands down for you shortly. And we are back here, and we have some hands prepared for both the audience and for Gazzy B to break down. By the way, guys, if you're listening to this on an audio platform, we'll walk the action a little bit. Obviously, though, we do have slides up here, so a bit more geared for the visual members of the chat. But let's go ahead and jump in. So these are going to be 200, 400 hands with a 400 big blind ante. Before we even get into anything here, Gazzy, brief primer on how we play with a $400 big blind ante at 200, 400.
Open a little bigger, I guess, is one of the main things. Open a little tighter under the gun because the big blind is going to be more incentivized to defend. Defend your big blind a little bit wider as well. But for the most part, just open a little bit bigger.
Sounds good. Okay, let's jump into it. All right, so this first hand, we're going to be looking at a hand that was played between Garrett Adelstein and Patrick Antonius.
Yeah.
We got about 150-ish K stacks here to begin the hand. Looks like we've got Patrick opening it up in late position. Garrett going for the three with ace-king, obviously very standard, and out of the small blind. And then Antonius decides to go ahead and 4-bet to 16,000 here over a $6,000 3-bet. Gazzy, your thoughts on this play?
My thoughts are, how is this guy making people's top 5 all-time poker player lists? I mean, how is that a thing? Obviously, an OG from back in the day and all that jazz, but has Patrick really done enough to be considered one of the best of all time, in my opinion? I don't think so. The 4-bet itself, really don't love it. We want to choose much better candidates than this. When we're in position, we're flatting a bunch of our king, queen, king, jack suited type hands. We use some ace 5, ace 4, ace 8 suited type hands, a little bit of ace queen offsuit, 9-7 suited. This stack depth just plays really nicely as a call. Let's call, see a flop, see what happens. Definitely don't want to 4-bet this.
Two things here, Gazzy. First off, make sure to stick close to your mic. Sometimes when you back up, it gets kind of quiet. Some people in the chat mentioned that. And then the second thing is, I had your top 5 list from last week, and I totally forgot. We need to talk about your list because yours was had some pretty interesting takes there. So we'll pull that up here at the end as well. We'll add a little segment in, but we'll get back to that in a moment. So with the 9-7 suited here, it just doesn't seem like a very nice hand to 4-bet. I guess maybe one of the advantages is you're not going to block too many. You kind of unblock some bluffs, right? You unblock some suited wheel aces, maybe some kind of Broadway hands that might choose to bluff. So maybe you have like a little bit of an unblocker effect there, but it just seems like it would be so much stronger here to be using your suited aces and maybe some offsuit Broadways yourself.
Absolutely, yeah. I think this hand, this stack depth just plays so nicely as a call. You've got a very loose, aggressive player in Garrett who's going to do a ton of not five bet shoving, but, you know, five betting, a lot of flatting your four bet. At this stack depth, I just feel like, you know, we're going to see a flop a lot of the time. We don't have too much fold equity. And as you say, sure, we have some unblockers, but we have some very poor blockers to the strongest parts of Garrett's range as well. Yeah, I just call this and see a flop always.
Well, the open's to 1,200, three bets to 6K. Can we really call with 9-7 suited?
Stack depth, were we playing 4-800s? 2-400s. Yeah, yeah, I mean, we're 400 big blinds deep. I absolutely think we can call this for sure. You know, 150 big blinds, it becomes kind of questionable. But, if, you know, one of the main things that changes when you're this deep is obviously your flying ranges get wider, particularly in position. Hands like this become a slam dunk call.
Okay. Nice. Most of the time when I go review my ring hands that I lose at, I realize that I should have folded preflop. So it's good to see some looser play being rewarded, question mark. We're going to find out. All right, so Patrick four bets, yeah, and Garrett calls. Any thoughts here on Garrett's shoes with ace king versus the four bet? Are we ever re-raising this, or do we like the call?
I think both options are completely fine. This becomes one of our really nice five bet bluffs, if you like, because it blocks aces and kings, and obviously when it gets flattered by queens and jacks, it's doing really well. So five betting is completely fine. But I would just always flat. Versus a player like Patrick, who I don't think Garrett will have played with Patrick very often at all. Yeah, I think just calling here. At this stack depth, you know, 400 big blinds effective. There's a sort of like a stack size area where you don't want to play a five bet range, and it's between like 140 and 200 big blinds. But anything over and above that, you for sure want a five bet range because you want to five bet your aces and, you know, some kings. So you would need some five bet bluffs, and ace king would certainly make it in there. But calling a certain
five. You know what? Interesting note. I played only five bet jams, any stack depth versus really? Daniel. Yeah, really? Only jams. You actually lose very little value playing only jams, even as you get deeper. So and then your jam range is just like aces, kings, and then king starts to get weighted against it, and then you just have some ace five suited and a little bit of ace king in there.
Did you ever have like a 500 big blind ace five suited jam versus Daniel?
Never came up, but I was ready.
You were ready.
I was locked and loaded. Awesome. I'm sure we had some at some. I have to check the database. It's been so long now. Okay. So Garrett does call. I do agree with you. I like the play. We take a flop. Flop is queen 9-4, two hearts. Garrett has ace of diamonds, king of hearts. So Garrett flops two overs with the second nut backdoor flush draw with king of hearts. And Patrick flops middle pair, middle kicker. Garrett checks, and then Tony says about 14,000 into a pot of roughly 33,000. Thoughts on this bet and the size here?
So he bets 14 into 46 or into 32?
I think it should be 32. Because, yeah, okay. Or it should be 33 because it should be 16 plus 16, 32 plus the roughly 1,000. So it should be about 33,000.
I think it's too big. You have three sizes in four bet pots generally, quarter pot, one third pot, and half pot. I use half pot on like 5-6-3 where you're not betting that often. A board like this, which is relatively good for you, I think one third is fine. I think, you know, one thing I talk about when I'm doing coaching and working for Upswing, et cetera, is really consistent strategies. So like I say, I use 25, 33, and 50. And this is something you see a lot in live poker, a lot of like 40% and 20% and 15%, and then back to 45%, et cetera. So if I'm in Patrick's shoes here, I bet quarter pot, one third, or 50%, always depending on what the texture is. And on this texture, I think this makes it into our one third range. I think, you know, 40-50%, just a little too big. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, so when you say this board is good for us, is that really the case? When I see this flop, I think of it as being a relatively good one for the three betting player, right? Because when you three bet, call four bet, basically all of the suited Broadways have kind of connected here other than like a couple of the ace jack, ace 10 suited. Even then, you know, obviously they can have hearts or clubs. Then also there's a bunch of queen X hands that could want a three bet call four bet. Hands like nines, tens, jacks, queens are all fine continuing on this board versus one bet. Is this really actually a good board for the four better?
Yeah, I'm pretty confident it is. Obviously, the four better is aces and kings, which is a massive advantage. I think Garrett is going to five bet his aces a lot. His king's a decent amount, having seen him play on live at the bike quite a lot. I think he's going to five bet these hands very high frequency. Both players have queens at relatively similar frequency. I think Garrett has more pocket nines in his range. The four doesn't really connect with either player. So I think that given the fact that Patrick has got more aces and kings and quite a lot of ace queen offsuit that Garrett just can't have here, I think this is a better board for Patrick.
Okay, so we thought the flop size was a little bit too big. Is this a hand that we would be betting very often?
I think you just want to simplify and bet your entire range here. Given the stack depth, I think it's fine to just bet everything that you've decided to four bet. You have so few air balls here and so many strong hands, I think I would just bet everything. So I think the size is a little too big. The decision to bet is fine, in my opinion.
Okay. Now over to Garrett. When you have ace-king here, one of the interesting things when you face this kind of aggression in four pots is when you have ace-king in these situations, and it can apply to the same thing with a hand like ace-queen a little bit when it's like a king high board.
Yeah,
you actually have pretty good removal against most of the value range, right? You block aces, you block kings, you block ace-queen, you block king-queen. So ace-king is kind of a cool hand that blocks a lot of the value bets your opponent can have. And then additionally, you can obviously improve to some top pairs too. So yeah. I would think this is a relatively standard check call here on the flop from Garrett.
Yeah, even without a heart, I'd be calling here all the time. You know, as you say, your pair outs are live a lot of the time. He's ahead of hands like, you know, ace-jack that Patrick might elect to four bet, you know, ace-5 suited. He's ahead a lot of the time, and if he is behind, he's got really nice backdoors and really nice overcards. So yeah, pretty easy call for Garrett here in this spot.
Okay, Garrett does make the call. The turn is an offsuit deuce. Garrett checks once again. Now with about what we got before this bet, it's got to be about $60,000 in the pot. Garrett checks and Patrick decides to bet $25,000. So this is a very confusing bet because we have middle pair, we have some showdown. If our opponent has a hand like king jack suited, king ten suited, jack ten suited, obviously we're ahead. We're now making it so our opponent kind of has to beat us. We're sort of charging draws. What are we doing?
Yeah, it's a weird spot. So I've spoken a little bit about my own flop strategy. When deeper, my turn sizing scheme is to set up for a river shove. You're always aiming for around about, you know, 0.8 SPR. So I think it's a little small from Patrick. I'd rather go like 30,000 and set up for that nice 0.75 SPR on the river. From Patrick's point of view, I don't know why he's betting. Is he bluffing? Is he value betting? Does he even know what he's doing in terms of those two options? Really not sure what this bet accomplishes. Garrett has a lot of better hands in his range that are going to continue. You deny equity from hands like, you know, king, jack of spades and stuff like that. But for the most part, this is not great, in my opinion. From Garrett's point of view, having the king of hearts is really nice as opposed to having the ace of hearts. If you have the ace of hearts, you block hands like ace-8 suited, ace-5 suited, which should in theory be in Patrick's 4-bet bluffing range. So having the king of hearts, a lot of people might think you block a lot of his bluffs, but I think hands like king-jack and king-10 of hearts are just going to call the 3-bet. They're not going to 4-bet that often in position. So having the king of hearts as opposed to the ace of hearts isn't so bad. You unblock his bluffs, but personally, I'm just going ahead and folding here. I think that this is just a little too ambitious to call again with ace-king. What do you think yourself?
I would agree with most of that assessment. I did have a thought on the turn size. Typically speaking, in these 4-bet pot situations, I go for a geometric size after my flop size. So I would be going, I think, a good amount bigger here in the turn if I did bet. Like, I think I would be leaning something more like 35,000 or so. Okay. Maybe even 38, something where I have the exact same size as my turn river bets. And what I've also found is a lot of two-tone flops, when you brick turn, it tends to like that larger size as well. So I think, what's your reason for going for this smaller size setup, like a 0.8 SPR river jam, instead of using something more geometric?
I think it just makes for a really nice river strategy. You have enough fold equity. I think just aiming for that 0.75 river stats, perhaps an old habit of mine that needs to be broken, but it just sets up for a really nice river jam of, you know, around about 75% the size of the pot.
Yeah, that seems like something that I used to do, that I've kind of moved away from, just that into more geometric situations. And as an example, I think when the turn is like, let's just say this is a deuce of hearts, then the smaller sizes I think are going to be more applicable. But I feel like here, just geometric seems probably good.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if the heart comes in, then, you know, the solver is going to favor that smaller size, is mostly the case. But obviously on these, you know, these brick turns, I'd personally just go like 30,000, and it gives us 102K into a pot of 120, something like that. Just seems like a really nice spot for us to shove on the river.
Why?
I don't know. It's just an old habit of mine. I think it's just something
nice. Nice. Glad to know that's based in based on math and science.
Yeah, for sure.
Also, for you guys, I think I explained this, but if I didn't, when I say geometric, I mean that the percentage of pot you're betting will be the same on all streets. So if we start betting geometric on the turn, it means that we would bet the percentage of pot, which would give us the same percentage of pot bet in the river. So, you know, if it's a 60% pot turn bet, then a 60% pot river bet would be all in. So that's basically the idea there with geometric. A little easier to figure out online than when you're at the table, but for still. Sure. Okay, so yeah, as for Garrett's call, I mean, it is a small bet, and again, our removal is kind of nice versus the value range that he's representing. But now we're getting to a point where we're not even going to have maneuverability where there's rivers that we can credibly bet. Mm-hmm. We're basically going to end up in just sort of pray that our ace king wins at showdown here. Mm-hmm. And then we also kind of open the door for our opponent to just be betting twice thin for value here with a hand like jacks or nine that can take their showdown on the river. Mm-hmm. But that's not what happens. Garrett check calls and we get a river 10 of hearts. Garrett checks once again and Patrick bets 80,000 with 27,000 left behind.
Yeah.
Garrett tanks and folds. And by the way, love the fold here, Garrett.
Yeah, I think this is top tier folds. I'm not sure I'd be able to make this one myself. But in all seriousness, yeah, I'm not sure what Patrick's up to. It obviously is a very scary card for Garrett if he's got a hand like pocket jacks or king queen suited or ace queen. I just don't understand this bet at all, to be honest. We have all the ace king combos with a heart in them that can bluff. We have maybe some of these old school guys that might have like ace jack offsuit with a heart as well. I just feel like this does not make it into our bluffing range, as well as that we block hands like jack nine suited, 9-8 suited, which are going to be in Garrett's range sometimes, that are going to fold. So we block a lot of his folds. We have some showdown value. Obviously, if Garrett's playing ace king like this, then we have some showdown value. I'm not sure what this accomplishes, to be honest. Garrett has some flushes in his range as well. If the queen of hearts is on the board, then maybe not the worst play in the world, but Garrett has got like queen jack of hearts, king queen of hearts, ace queen of hearts, and then a bunch of other flush draws as well that have just gotten there. I'm really not in love with this play at all.
What's our thinking here with the bet 80, leave 27 behind? Because when I see this river, I'm thinking, all right, I no longer can go for value with overpairs. Mm-hmm. This is a river we're gonna have to just take our showdown with aces and kings.
Yeah.
So my minimum hand that I can reasonably value bet here is maybe something like queen 10, somewhere in that neck of the woods. Maybe not even. It's close. So maybe this is a situation where if we're just jamming essentially straights or better, or we're just betting straights or better, we should just be going all in.
For sure. For sure.
Yeah.
I completely agree. I think the size is a little, I'm really not sure what it accomplishes. This is like a tournament thing, you know, where tournament players, if they're bluffing, they leave themselves a little behind so they can spin it up. I've never seen a cash game before. I don't know the logic behind it. I'd love to hear Patrick's thoughts on betting 80,000 and not 27. Maybe he just didn't want to say all in because his voice would be a little shaky or something like that. But coming back to, you know, what hands he can shove, I don't think queen 10 is going to make it into the 4-bet range. So it's literally just king jack, pocket queens. I don't think he has 10s or 9s ever. So it's like top set as a minimum, and you're absolutely right. If you've got a value hand here, you know, you're repping queens plus, you just want to go ahead and go all in. I'm not sure what this accomplishes.
But it worked.
It did.
Yeah. All right. That's our first 10. All right, moving on. So this next hand is going to involve Negreanu. He opens up in the hijack with the ace-queen offsuit, ace-diamonds, queen of spades. JRB, 3 bets in the small blind with king-queen offsuit. And Negreanu does make the call. I think this is a relatively standard-ish hand. Are we pure 3-betting the king-queen here pre-flop, Gazzy, or are we mixing some folds?
I would pure 3-bet. You've got Tom behind, and you know Tom's always very loose, very aggressive. We don't want to let Tom in with his 9-7 offsuit type stuff. We just want to, you know, 3-bet, get our hand to heads up. Obviously, we've got more equity with less players in the pot. So, yeah, I would go ahead and 3-bet. If we've got one of the fun players at the table, for sure you can call this. I don't think these guys are paying any rake either, so they don't have to think about that. But I think calling is fine if you've got the right player behind. But with a player like Tom Dwan, I would just go ahead and 3-bet this all.
Do you consider a four bet with the ace queen? I imagine low frequency.
I think it will be there in theory. In reality, I'm probably just calling versus JRB. I would four bet ace queen suited, which is never going to be in there in theory, and it would just be a pure value four bet. And ace king offsuit, I would four bet always versus JRB, just because he's so loose and so wide. We've seen like the famous 5-3 suited all in situation. So yeah, versus that type of player, I'd be four betting. I'd widen my four bet range for value, and I would never four bet like, you know, ace five suited or ace eight suited. My ranges change depending on the type of player I'm playing against, and I would have virtually no four-bet bluffs versus a player like JRB, but I'd widen my value range to include hands like pocket tens, pocket jacks, ace-queen suited.
I feel like at this stack depth, given that we're something like 500 to 700, however many blinds deep the deepest players are, I think that a lot of the suited aces are going to take almost all of the offsuit combos. So I would be pretty shocked if we didn't see some four-betting from the ace-8 suited, ace-5 suited kind of hands. But again, I don't know ring ranges, so...
I mean, in theory, they're in there, absolutely, yeah. But what I'm saying is I would deviate from these ranges and I would play them as calls, as pure calls, and I would widen my four-bet range with hands like ace-queen suited and ace-jack suited and, you know, pocket tens, which are going to be very high-frequency calls, but versus JRB, no disrespect to him, I'd be widening that four-bet value range and tightening up my bluffing range.
How does our four-bet range shift if our opponent is wearing that beanie specifically? I'm thinking tighter.
Yeah, tighter, but certainly wider for value. But I mean, pocket tens is, I'm forwarding that all day, every day.
I like the wider for value versus that beanie. Okay. Yeah. Negreanu does call the three bet.
Yeah. And wider comes... my three bet range versus that fucking comb over as well. But anyway.
There you have it. ace jack nine rainbow. JRB decides to fire here with the gut shot to the nuts. 4K into 8.8. And now over to Negreanu, he decides to call. This seems pretty standard. I will say on the flop, this is the kind of board we talked a little bit about earlier, although we talked about single race pot. I think this is the kind of board where you can do a bunch of different things. You could split your range up and you can have some small bets and some big bets. I think on this board, you're definitely going to have a chunk of hands that want to go for a very large size in your value range. You know, if I three bet a hand like jacks here or nines here, definitely going to want to be using some big sizes. Same thing kind of goes for ace jack. And then you're going to want to use some small sizes with hands like aces or just some ace-x hands, maybe some thin value bets with hands like queens. Mm-hmm. How are you splitting up your range here on the flop?
I don't split my range. It's just not something I do. If you run this through a solver, the difference in EV between having one size and two sizes is minimal. So that simplification.
My man.
Yeah,
my like man. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
I mean, in my opinion, obviously you will generate a little more EV by having two sizes, but if your strategy is easier to play, then you're not going to butcher it as much and your EV is going to be completely fine. So the EV that you generate from having two sizes is just non-existent. Double Broadway rainbow, simplified strategy is bet one third with my entire range. Simple as that.
You bet one third entire range in the spot.
On double Broadway flops, absolutely, yeah. That works really well. What do you think of yourself? You bigger size, smaller size?
Well, when I think of a board like this, I've usually used big sizes, lower frequency. So I've worked a lot of checks in on these. But again, this is ring and our ranges are going to be a bit different. So
for what it's worth, the larger strategy applies when there's a flush draw on board. For example, something like king, queen, deuce, flush draw, you're supposed to use 75 or check. Again, I still use one third or check. And it's just because the difference in EV is really quite minimal. And playing a large bet size only strategy, if you're mixing, you have small and big, it's fine. But if you're playing a big bet size only strategy, it is really quite difficult to play. And you factor in a lot of checks with hands like kings and queens, which in theory is obviously fine. But from an exploitative point of view, I just don't want to check top set and second set. I'd much rather just bet my entire range for one third. Because I think it is, from an exploitative point of view, a slightly higher EV strategy.
Okay, interesting. Very interesting. JRB decides to go for a half pot. Seems fine. And then Negreanu goes for the call. I think this is pretty standard from both.
For sure.
What might be the most standard street of the entire session? We move on. Turn is an offsuit four. So now we have ace jack 9-4 completes the rainbow. So we will not have any flush draws in this hand. And JRB decides to fire again. Sizing up. This time he goes for a $14,000 bet into a pot that's about 16,000, 17,000. So just about 80-85% pot now from JRB saying, hey, I've got one of these good hands. I have an ace jack, I have a jack nine suited, I have a set, or I'm bluffing. And once again, Negreanu now with top pair. So I think Negreanu's decision here is just, there's not really any decision. He's obviously just going to have to call. Yeah. What are our thoughts here on turn size, the way that we're going to barrel this turn and the size that we decide to use? And you know what? Spoiler, I kind of like it.
Yeah, I think it's fine. I would go like 75% here. There's not much of a difference between 75 and the 85 that he's elected to bet. But on Jack 9, Ace 4, what else have we got to bluff? We've got King 10, Queen 10, King Queen. King Queen is probably the best of the bunch because one, we block our opponent's best top pairs. And two, we want to have as many overcards to as many cards as there can be. So I like King 10 has only got one overcard to the Jack. And like King Queen might have two live pair outs. So we prefer to use Antlet King Queen before King 10 and Queen 10. But I would just be betting a lot of my gut shots at a very high frequency.
Is there logic here that whatever the lowest pocket pair that we'd be three betting some frequency out of the blinds here, that's going to be a really nice triple because we unblock all the kinds of draws that we want our opponents to be able to call fold?
That's exactly it, yeah. Pocket sixes, pocket sevens. We're going to mix these in with our barrels. And obviously they've got two very nice outs for the times that we ping the river. But yeah, pocket sixes, pocket sevens, King Queen, as mentioned, you know, really nice gut shot, really nice blockers, really nice pair outs versus hands like Jack 10 and Jack 8 suitors and stuff like that.
Not having a 10 is nice here actually too.
Yeah, for sure. But Daniel's gonna have to fold hands like King 10 and 10-7 suited is probably in Daniel's range as well, so not having a 10 is pretty nice as well. But I think this is well played on the flop and on the turn from my man JRB.
All right, and we take a river. The river comes the 10. JRB gets there, and he decides to go for the whole enchilada, betting 60,000 into 45,000. So this is a situation where out of position, I think you should actually be using... So first we got to kind of break down the ranges, right? First off is how often does each player have straights? Mm-hmm. The reality is that the three betting player has a good amount more straights than the imposition player does because imposition is going to have to mainly fold those on the turn. Perfect. So we do have a little bit of a range asymmetry where I like some larger sizes from out of position. Mm-hmm. That said, there is like a middling class of value bets that the imposition player has that the opposition player doesn't have where you have ace 10, jack 10, 10, 9. Probably not 10, 9. Probably not that many Jack 10s either, but definitely some Ace 10. I feel like maybe when I look at a spot like this, traditionally on board changing turns and rivers, particularly rivers, you see out of position use a lot of block bet size.
For sure.
But this might actually be a spot where because of the range asymmetry, where out of position just has so many more straights in position that you actually can kind of get away with a big size. What's your thoughts?
I would split my range here. So whenever I use a large turn size, I'll never use a small river size. If I use small turn, then I'll have small river and big river. But you should very rarely have a large turn size and then have a small river size unless the board changes significantly. For example, a flush completes or, you know, this is a perfect example. You know, King Queen gets there, which is also a decent part of JRB's range. So I think if I was approaching this, I would have a small size and I would have a big size. You know, my small size is always 1/3. And my big size here would be either pot or a slight overbet. I don't know if JRB is splitting his range here or if he's, you know, studied board changing rivers in the solver. Something tells me he hasn't and he's made a straight and wants to get paid. But yeah, I think the solver is going to split here for sure. Have some small bets because the solver is still going to want to bet a hand like ace king, for example. And then obviously there are some other hands like ace jack is maybe going to go into the smaller size given it blocks so much of our opponent's calling range. And then you've got hands like pocket nines, pocket jacks, king queen that unblock your opponent's best calls, and you just want to go ahead and bomb them. So I think this is a well played hand by JRB, to be honest. I mean, obviously we don't know about his general river strategy and if he's splitting his range, but I think it's pretty well played, to be honest.
Yeah, I think it makes sense. What are your thoughts here in Negreanu's shoes? Because I guess we have to kind of look at all of our hands and what are we trying to block. And when I see this size from the river, we're really up against sets or straights, I think. Yeah. almost entirely, and I would lean more towards straights. So from that perspective, having the queen is kind of nice. Mm-hmm. how are you structuring your continue range here on the river?
Well, obviously we've got a lot of really natural calls, hands like ace jack, ace nine, ace 10, ace four. Even pocket nines is not going to raise, it's just going to go ahead and click that call button. So we've got some really easy decisions. You know, all our two players are going to have to pay them off. Certainly our best two pairs are ace jack and ace 10. But as you mentioned, you know, the queen blocking king queen.
Is ace 10 a good call, actually? Ace 10 feels like it's probably a fold.
Why do you think ace 10 is probably a fold?
Well, because I feel like for our opponent to be bluffing here, they kind of need a 10.
That's true, actually. Yeah, that's a really good point.
I feel like I wouldn't want to have a 10, and I also feel like blocking the 10 doesn't actually block any value bets. So I feel like ace jack is a slam dunk call. Ace 9 is probably you just hate the world.
Just hate everything and put the money in. Yeah, but yeah, I think that's right. Ace 10 and ace 10, maybe not the best call. And like ace queen, you're gonna have to call sometimes, particularly versus a guy like JRB. If we take the theory out of it for a few seconds, he's gonna go ahead and blast off those king 10, queen 10s, 10-8 suited if it's in there. So for Daniel, it's a really sticky spot. But I would call sometimes. I think I would spin for 25%. I do my Mike Brady technique. I'd look at the chip and whatever way it's facing.
Is Mike taking credit for that now?
It wasn't him that invented it. Was it you? Mm.
No, it wasn't me. It wasn't Mike. It was long before either of our times. I started using it and told people, and it was already a thing. We can only claim credit for things we actually started. Like Phil Hellmuth is the luckiest of all time. We can't claim things outside of our.
That's weird to say that, because when Mike told me about it, he was like, "I've invented this really cool trick for randomizing. Would you like to hear it?"
And oh man, Mike's gonna take some heat for this. What year was that?
Last year, like.
This might be the worst take of the podcast. That might be the number one worst take. Wow.
I believe them. He's bluffed me good.
Oof. Yeah. He must have randomized that one. Okay. Anyway. Yeah. I think I would agree with this.
It's a really horrible spot, and it looks like it's just a snap fold, but you got to call sometimes. You for sure got to call sometimes here.
Queen's a nice card to have.
Queen's a nice card to have. Fold your ace 5 and your ace 8 and your ace 3 and stuff like that. Call this sometimes.
Okay. DeGrom did let it go. All right. Next hand. Final hand, actually. So this one, we have an under the gun limp from Tom Dwan with 8-5 suited while he's on his phone. What are your thoughts on this, what we're looking at here, Gazzy B?
Okay, a couple of things I want to talk about. I've been tweeting relentlessly about these guys being on their phones. I mean, the prestige of high stakes poker, put your phone away for a couple hours and just like play the game. That's the first thing I want to say. Secondly, I know you've had a lot of things to say in the past about Tom Dwan, but he's my poker hero, and it breaks my heart to see him limping and ruffling around your 8-5 suited. I don't know what he's up to. I would just go ahead and muck that personally. The limp call seems a little, it's just sad to see, to be honest.
I really dislike when people are on their phone during games in general. That said, someone please don't tweet a picture of me on my phone.
Or me.
Once in a while, I mean, you just kind of like have to take something, but in general, if you can not be on your phone, it makes the stream a lot better quality for everyone else. So that's certainly something nice to see. And then what are we doing with this limp? This is like, you know what this is like, Gazzy? This is like when you wake up and you have a kind of important thing and you look at your wardrobe and you're just like, I'm giving up on everything. And you put sweatpants on, you put the big baggy t-shirt on, you show up and the people are looking at you like, oh my God, he came to this dress like that. That's the poker equivalent. Is you're just saying, I'm just giving up. And you just throw the 8-5 suit in for a limp in the early position.
This is heartbreaking, to be honest. Like I say, he's my poker hero, and he's in there. I can only hope that he thought it was the big blind and he just put it out there. Because you see where the button is, that's maybe credible. But in reality, he's probably just limping the 8-5 suited.
Yeah, maybe, right? He was on his phone. All right, so anyway, he limps in with the 8-5 suited. Tilly isolates the fish with king-jack offsuit from the low jack to 3K. Pretty big size raise.
Yeah.
But again, with the ante, that makes some sense.
Yeah.
Still probably a little big, but makes the raise. Holtman on the button calls with the pocket twos. Yeah. Certainly seems like the standard play here. Although I was looking at some ranges where you actually fold hands like this on the button, and it made me a little bit sad, Gazzy.
I have just done a module for Upswing Poker on live poker, and if you're playing in a rigged environment, hands like this are just snap folds, and it sucks, but tight is right given the rig structure. But if you're playing in an unrigged game, you get to play hands like this at a relatively high frequency, which is nice.
Nice. So basically down at the lodge you can play these. Anyway,
where poker is being reborn, you can play these. Yeah, I can't wait to visit, by the way. I'm going to be there later in the year. It's going to be fun.
It'll be awesome. Be good to hang out. Anyway, so back to Tom. He does decide to make the call. I don't think we really have to dissect that one. Okay. Oh, shoot. Oh, yeah, here we go. All right, so the flop comes king, nine, deuce, two hearts.
Yeah.
The action goes check. Tilly bets 5K into what was probably about 10. Maybe a little bit on the big size there for the flop bet. Mm-hmm. Holtman raises his set to 17. Tilly three bets to 50K. Holtman calls. Okay, so I think really most of these are pretty standard. The bet from Tilly a little bit big, but certainly fine. The Holtman raise definitely standard with the bottom set. What are your thoughts on this three bet and the flop from Tilly?
I think, first of all, I've seen all these episodes and Jennifer Tilly has been amazing. She's been driving the action. She's been fearless. She's been really good fun to watch. But I don't think this three bet is very good at all for a number of reasons. First of all, Holtman's been playing quite tight. If we talk about table images, he's been playing quite tight, playing quite passive. No disrespect to him. He's been kind of shaky when he's been putting big bets in, et cetera. I don't expect him to be very wide here at all. I don't expect him to be raising hands like King 10 or King 8 or Queen 10 of diamonds, which would be a necessity for Tilly to make this three bet. So yeah, completely fine for Tilly to bet, obviously a little on the big side. Holtman's raise at this stack depth, mandatory on a board like King 9 deuce. Jennifer has got so many top pairs in her range. But the three bet, just not a thing. One, we block some really high equity hands that we're trying to get value from, hands like Jack 10 of hearts and Ace Jack of hearts and Queen Jack of hearts. And two, we're three betting top pair average kicker versus a relatively tight passive player who's going to have deuces, going to have nines, going to have King 9. I think those are the only value hands that Holtman can have here, to be honest with you. So yeah, really not a fan of this three bet at all.
Yeah, having the Jack of hearts feels like a terrible card to have, because sure, we certainly want our opponent to have that one.
Mm-hmm. And what I'm about to say, I mean this in the nicest way possible. Do we think that Jennifer is, thinking about that? Does she think, well, I've got the Jack of hearts, I block a lot of my opponent's calling range? Or do we think that she sees a wet board, she sees that she's got top pair, and she just wants to charge the draws out there?
Possible it's the second one, but what I will say is that we don't try to think about poker, Gazzy, based on what we think our opponents may or may not be thinking. We try and do the right play.
Right.
So okay, we don't have to worry about that. Okay. You're in luck.
No worries. Jennifer, just in case you're watching, I still love you.
Yep. Okay. yeah. I think this is a pretty clear flop call. I don't really see much reason for three bet. And if you are going to three bet the flop with a different hand, I don't like the size either. This is too big. We should be using a smaller size that sets up for a more reasonable turn jam, where the pot's going to be massive compared to what Holtman has left behind on the turn. So the turn comes the four of hearts. The flush completes. Both players have to be a little bit scared by this. Mm-hmm. Tilly checks. Holtman bets 50K, leaving 28 behind.
70.
Yeah. So, no, wait, hold on. No.
Yeah, 100%.
Okay. So this should be pretty clearly a jam from Holtman. I don't know why we're leaving 28 behind. Maybe he just saw a top five all-time player, Patrick Antonius, do it. Trying to bust out the move. What do you think?
I think the solver's going to have some small bets here for sure. What's the SPR? So he's got 128 and there's 110 in there. So I actually don't think that the solver's going to jam here. If the SPR is 1.2, the solver's going to play a lot of small bets. Solver does a lot of small betting on flush completing turns and rivers. So I think if we're talking about this from a theory point of view, he should bet like 25, 30% okay, or something like that. Obviously he's an amateur player. He's got bottom set and he's probably a little bit panicky at this stage. I certainly don't begrudge him for that. But yeah, from a theory point of view, I think the bet is completely fine, but certainly too big.
Would you start, if I was in the spot with a set, I would really start to wonder about what I'm ahead of, because yeah. I got three bet on the flop, the flush completes, and now I face a check.
Yeah, for sure.
Can we really bet jam this? I hate to be the nit, and obviously, obviously, it's great in this spot to bet jam, given what we see, what the cards they have. But is there logic for a small bet check river here?
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, there's very little that we can get value from our opponent. As when our opponent three bets the flop and then checks his turn, our opponent has a lot of pocket kings, pocket nines, maybe some King 9 suited, a lot of flushes, a lot of like Ace 5 of hearts in theory are going to be three bets in this spot. Not a hand like Ace 10 of hearts, but a hand like Ace 5 of hearts is going to be preferred. And we're ahead of one of those hands. We're ahead of King 9 suited, and that's pretty much it. So I think a small turn bet, even a turn check, to be honest, isn't completely unreasonable from a theory point of view.
Yeah, check seems kind of okay. What I kind of like about a bet is I feel like you handcuff your opponent a little bit with that play.
For sure.
I don't think you're going to face jams from the higher sets. So you're just going to see check call. And then if you get jammed on, it's obviously ugly. but at least now you can bet call where they might have a high heart and be bluffing. Whereas if I check and they jam river, well, I guess it's the same, kind of works out similar.
For sure, yeah. I mean, if we're talking about this from a theory perspective, the Jennifer is supposed to have some ace queen with the ace of heart type combos in there,
right?
So that she can have bluffs here and she's not just really, you know, weighted towards value. So there is a little more merit to betting than we both may have initially thought. But yeah. And then we get this nasty river for Jennifer, really, really nasty. And Holtman sticks it in.
Tough river, jack of spades, Tilly River's two pair, top two pair, and check, and Holtman jams his set of twos. Once again, I would be, you know what I found? I found in some of these games where you're on just an enormous number of big blinds, I feel like people end up playing it similar to like they have 100 big blinds. And then I'm the guy with 480 blinds that's thinking, this should be really. And then if I show it down, I'm like, oh man, you had that. Oh, that's it. I get shown the nuts a lot too. Maybe I'm just living in fear of my career has just become, how can I fold the strong hand of the nuts? But
I hear you.
Yeah, I think if you come this far with the king jack, kind of hard to let it go on an offsuit jack.
I mean, yeah, you've river top two, but I mean, if we just take a moment and think about it, there's just nothing that we beat. I mean, I can't think of a single bluff that Holtman can have here. Well, I guess he can have queen
ace,
jack of diamonds.
Five of diamonds.
That's a little dicey to call it.
It is a little dicey. Queen
jack and jack 10 of diamonds. You can beat two combos. Those are the only real
ace combos. Nine of diamonds.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
It shows how dire the situation is. We're trying to pick out the one combo.
The 10% flop rate, though, ace nine of diamonds, I guess you can have that on the river. Yeah. Nasty.
We talked about it earlier. Sometimes you just got to raise those middle pair top kickers and then it comes back to haunt you, you know?
Yeah. This is an exact replica of what we were talking about. There's something I wanted to talk about. Yeah. So I actually saw this hand and I felt kind of bad for Jennifer. She was like listing the hands that she could beat. And one of the reasons she called was because she thought her opponent could have ace-king, which is just never in a million years is Holtman going to play ace-king this way in terms of, like, you know, shoving the river, if that makes sense. So, but, I mean, if we're looking at it from a theory point of view, she just beats so little, but it's so hard to fold top two when you've come this far. But she's got way better hands. She's got, in theory, she's got, you know, flushes that are going to three-bet the flop and check the turn. She's got kings. She's got nines. We're not really that high up in our range here. This is kind of the bottom, to be honest. It's pretty close to the bottom if you think about it.
Well, I think the real reason that he can't have ace king is, I think, pre-flop is almost always going to be ace king. But regardless of that, if I had ace king and I flatted pre-flop, I'd probably raise the flop. And if I got three bet, I'd probably call. And then if I got this turn and I checked to me and I didn't have a heart, I'd probably bluff. So I don't know. Is ace king like that? In post-flop, I feel like, is it that insane to have ace king here?
I think so, yeah. I don't think he's going to bluff the turn and shove the river. I think ace king is just too high up, in my opinion. I think we've got
what can he have that's worse than ace king?
Jack 10 of diamonds, queen jack of diamonds,
ace 9 of diamonds. Okay, it's three combos, so that's it. Yeah. It's the three combos. Okay,
ace queen with the ace. I don't know. Yeah, we're really scraping the bottom of the barrel here, but I think ace king is not going to be, it certainly wouldn't make it into my bluffing range here.
What about, yeah, well, he definitely can't have king 9 because that would check for sure. So that's, we're definitely grasping at straws here, and I think she's improved to a hand that realistically doesn't beat any of the value before, and not really that many bluffs that make sense. And I think that a big part of this is just how big she threw about the flop.
Yeah, exactly. And obviously how big Holtman bet the turn as well. Both those mistakes from both players have led to this small jam. It's like a quarter pot or something like that on the river.
Got to give credit to Holtman. He fobbed a set and he fearlessly made sure that every dollar went in here and was good.
That's impressive. It's a skill in its own right. You know, making hands is one thing, but getting paid, that's impressive.
Yeah, I don't do much of that.
No.
I just make hands. It's unfortunate. All right. So that brings us to the conclusion here of these hands that I wanted to analyze. And any thoughts so far on High Stakes Poker, and you've been enjoying watching it, Gazzy?
Oh yeah, I absolutely love it. It's one of my favorite poker shows. The first episode was a tough watch, you know. It was really quite dire, and you know, the general consensus online was, you know, just wait and it'll pick up. And it's been really awesome. Guys like Jennifer Tilly, Chris is just, I don't know if you've been watching, but Chris is just bluffing every hand. Garrett Addison is obviously a joy to watch from a, you know, a poker point of view. It's been really good. I've really enjoyed it. Well worth the $10 a month.
Nice. Okay. Getting your PokerGo plug in. I like to hear it.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Let's move on then. And let's move into our final segment today called Have I Mentioned My Personal Life? And we're going to talk a little bit about a personal story. I got one, then Gazzy can tell a story as well if he would like to. So the other day, last week, I was involved in my first tornado warning situation, and someone told me there's tornadoes coming to Austin. Check it out. And I've never really been in an area that gets tornadoes, so I was unfamiliar with I didn't know, is this a real thing, or should people be scared, or is this like a nothing burger?
Okay.
And what I was told is if it's a watch, it means there might be tornadoes. But if it's a warning, it means there are tornadoes. So watch is just go about your business, but warning means seek shelter, basically.
Okay.
Then it gets upgraded from a watch to a warning. Okay. So now we're in official, there are tornadoes in the area.
Okay.
So I flip on the TV, and sure enough, there's a tornado going across the interstate. It just has a tornado, and it's just going across the interstate. And I look at it, and I'm thinking, huh, that's Interstate 35. Like, oh my God, it's headed to the lodge. Okay. The tornado is just... It's just barreling across the interstate headed towards the lodge. So I'm in a chat with a bunch of people. They say that there's some, like, you know, it's there's like a lot of wind there. Everything's okay. It went by. Nothing bad happened. Some staff had some minor damage on their homes. We just leased two new units for the lodge. And one of the new units, one of the panels on the top was like torn off, but apparently it was loose before. I'm not exactly sure what happened. So there was like a hole in one of the ceilings. But just minor cosmetic damage. Nothing happened. But I had to say, I was a little frightened when I see a tornado heading across the interstate right for the lodge. I was a bit worried.
That must have been pretty terrifying, to be honest. Some your new investment and there's a fucking tornado heading right at it.
Yeah.
Maybe a metaphor for all the legal stuff that, you know, I read about all this stuff. Apparently it changes all the time. It must be a little daunting, you know, investing in this business that...
Well, the legal side of this, look, we think we're pretty clearly in the green from the way that the statutes look with the Texas state law. They haven't changed in a very long time. And we think that we're good. And there's 70-ish businesses like that around the state. I think some places are having issues locally, like they had in Dallas. But even in Dallas, they recently had a victory where basically they tried to force them to shut down by changing the zoning of the rooms. And it got overturned, my understanding. So the rooms are good to go in Dallas. So realistically... Unless there's basically a reform, like a new bill that changes poker here, I think that we're good to go. But obviously, you never like to have your life in the hands of legislators or politicians for any matter. I think we all hear over the pond, as some would say, might remember Black Friday, where one day we just couldn't play poker online anymore. But the other side of this is, I think it's a great business. And despite all the people that are afraid, I do think that things are headed in a positive direction, and I hope it continues to go that way. Other than tornadoes,
all you got to do is watch out for these pesky tornadoes. Yeah, but it sounds really awesome. I chat to Mike about it from time to time, and he says it's a lot of fun. Must be really cool to like own your own business in that field that you've sort of dedicated your life to. It must be pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's nice. It's cool going in, and you know, you're going down to your own card room. It's pretty sweet. And the team's great. Like the staff at the lodge is amazing.
Yeah.
Very proud of the business, and we're obviously looking to build things out. A lot of people have been asking us when the stream's going to return. We're going to have our poker stream going. We're targeting a mid-April return.
Okay.
I think it's kind of likely we get it going before then, but we're going to be conservative. We hired a full-time stream producer, and we're doing we got a consultant out here, and we're updating things as we speak. And you know, maybe it'll be sooner than that, but right now we're targeting mid-April, and then we'll get the stream going. It was particularly brutal. Brad Owen released a vlog the other day, I think yesterday. And in the vlog, he showed some of the hands. It was like a 100, 200 game. Mm-hmm. And he kept having to say, here are the stream cuts out. And I'm like, oh my God. It happens like three or four different times. There's like stream cutouts. And I'm just like, Jesus, can't even get these. One of them is, and I'm all in for my biggest pot ever. And the stream cuts out. Like, oh my God.
That's so brutal, man. But you got an editor who's going to save Brad Owen so that he no longer has to...
Oh, is he going to edit in cards?
Oh, I don't know. I've trying to create my own vlog, so I've watched some of Brad's vlogs recently for market research, and I saw what you said, you know, the stream cuts out, and it's a bit of a pain in the ass for him and stuff like that. But,
yeah. What is prompting you to get in the vlog game?
Okay, so I've watched a few vlogs, and the caliber of poker player who elective logger, maybe not as strong as the poker Ooh. Community deserves. So Ooh. There's a niche in the market for a non-mega wreck poker player to vlog, in my humble opinion. So.
Are you talking shit about my vlogs?
No, not at all. Not talk. I haven't seen yours. I'm not talking about Brad. There's just, yeah, everyone seems to be not great in the nicest way possible. So I'm going to step in and see if I can do it. You know, it's a learning curve. It's a lot of fun. I've already got some beef with a couple of vloggers who don't like to be told that they're not great at poker, but you know, it's all part of the process.
I think the thing with vlogging is that, and really this is streaming, vlogging, any kind of poker content, you kind of have to decide what you want to be good at. Do you want to be good at the content or do you want to be good at the poker? And I think that they're both reasonable choices. I think if you build your own audience and you get the support of the community, I think that's a good business decision. But the reality is that the amount of time and effort that takes, I'm not saying it's impossible to be good at both, but I think that it's very difficult. And I think you're in a spot where you're already good at poker, so you can go in and spend more time on the vlog. On the vlogging side, but if you're trying to kind of build from scratch, like a lot of these vloggers, they start at 1, 2, 2, 5, maybe some 5, 10, maybe, probably not, and they kind of build from there. It's very difficult to spend the number of hours that are required to produce content people want to watch, and then also simultaneously be aggregating those hands into your queen 7-3s and queen 7-2s.
I think you're absolutely right. And before I say anything else, the guys I'm talking about, you know, your Brad Owens, your other names, your Rampages, etc. They are making so much money, and I've got nothing but respect for them being able to put themselves out there and release a vlog and get like 50,000 views in a day. So when I'm talking about, you know, like caliber of player, etc., I know it sounds kind of dickish, but in terms of how these guys, you know, they make their money, I've got nothing but respect for them. But coming back to what you just said, absolutely right. I recorded my first vlog and I edited it, and it took about fucking 3.5 days, and it was a mission. I'm very happy with the first one, but you're absolutely right. It's going to take a lot of.
Oh, here we go. I just found this. Okay, guys, if you want to check out poker vlogging but good at poker, you can check out Gazzy B over on the YouTube's. Got his first vlog up. How did you find the vlogging at the table? Because one thing I found is I don't have the pro setup. I know they have the little setup where they put the camera on. I find it very distracting to be trying to record stuff while I'm playing. And I also feel like it takes away from my interactions with other players. How have you found the experience of trying to record the hands while you're playing them?
Well, in the UK, it's a nightmare because you're not allowed to film in the casinos. There's a casino called Empire Casino in London. They've been very kind. They've, you know, given me a bunch of rules to follow, but they've been super great about it. But everyone at the table is really interested about it because they've never seen it before. So what I did, I get my camera and I get like two little chips underneath, and if I'm playing a hand that I want to vlog about, I just hit the record button. It's not like it's recording the whole time. It's a bit of a tell when someone's like about to raise and they hear the beep of my camera. But yeah, I just click the button. It starts recording. If the hand is tiny, I just delete that clip. I've had 4 days of playing where I've recorded, and only one of them has led to a vlog because of all the technical issues I've had so far. But everyone at the table has been super fun about it. Everyone's been inquiring about it. One guy at the table was like, "What's the name of your YouTube account?" And I said, "Gazzy B." And everyone at the table just like picked up their phone at the same time. And I was like, "Oh God, they're all going to check out the."
They're like, "This guy has no, where are all the subscribers?"
That's exactly it. Yeah.
Where are the vlogs?
Firing shots at everyone. I've got 300 subs on YouTube. I mean, what am I doing? You know. I've talked a lot of talk about this, so I've really got to back up now with some good content.
How often are you going to be posting vlogs?
Well, I was going to aim for 2 every week, but the fact that it took me about 13 hours to edit a 17-minute vlog, I'm probably going to go for 1 a week. And then I'm going to go to LA. I'm really hopeful the Commerce Casino will let me film, although it's kind of unlikely. But I'll find a workaround. And then I'm in LA for 4 weeks, and then I'm going to Vegas for the series. So yeah, 1 a week, I'd be really happy with that.
When you come by the lodge, we'll get you some good content. I'll get a thumbnail with you. We'll do some hands. Yeah,
that sounds really good. Sounds awesome.
That'll be good. Yeah, the vlogs are the amount of time that it takes to edit. I mean, yeah. I'm glad that I have an editor, so he does like the real heavy lifting. I just do the filming. It seems like an incredible amount of work, to be honest. Just to even get these things out. One of the things I've enjoyed with vlogging is, so when I see a lot of other people vlog, I feel like they try and put themselves in the best light, and they try and show these are the coolest hands. This is where I played a great play, and my vlog is really just. When I finish a session, I just empty out the bag of every clip And I basically just, unless it's a small pot, I just put it up there. So there's no filter. Every dumb hand I played goes in.
Yeah.
Every big pot, there's basically no winners. If I did winners, I would have had to get rid of my first five blocks. And so it's basically just, this is really what happened in my session play by play. My next vlog actually is going to be, so every Wednesday we have a mixed game where, it's the craziest mixed game in the country, I think. It's only 20-40, but you can call anything. You can make up games. That's fine.
Okay.
So we just play just the most absurd lineup of games. And lately we've been joining this variant called Fun Under the Gun.
Okay.
You look at your first two cards and you can call a game out of a 27 game list. So there's like 27 different games you can pick. So there's definitely some strategy. I had a hand that was kind of interesting. So I looked down, I have Queen 9 suited under the gun. What game do I call? Kind of a shit hand. You think you're doing okay, but you're really not. None of the low ball hands.
Just raise.
You can't raise into the gun. Everyone says that, by the way. You think every person's like, call hold'em and just raise. Like, you can't do that. That's not a winning raise.
I'm not flying all the way to Austin and folding Queen 9 suited under the gun. It's just not happening. I don't care what game it is.
Well, I think the play is you call PLO and then you hope that you work your way, because then you get more cards, and you work your way into like a king, queen, 10-9 kind of hand, you know, you kind of work your way in there, and then you have something a little bit playable. But
can you call six card PLO?
I mean, I don't see why not. I don't think it's on the approved list, but it is ring though. Six. Is there enough cards in the deck? You could probably call that. Yeah, you could probably call
that. Or five card at the worst, and hope for the best. I was playing six card the other night, and it's a mission. Just like looking at your cards, I was like, oh, I'm not on the internet anymore. I need to learn how to hold my cards. It was good though. It's good fun.
Six card ring PLO.
Six card, six handed PLO. Me and five fun players. It was a lot of fun, but
that sounds like it
for myself. So you're six ways to a flop every time. Everyone is just limping in. They just want to see a flop.
We play a little tic tac toe where the flop is I believe the corners. So it's a 3x3 grid. The flop is the corners. The turn is the completes it, and then the river is the middle. And you can it's best hand you can make using any board, but boards are all only three cards.
That sounds complicated as fuck. It sounds like fun, but complicated as fuck.
It is complicated, and there's plenty of playing the wrong game that happens to people all the time. Can we have to say
a drinking game while we're playing it, just to make it a little more complicated.
Well, that's already happening on the side, yeah.
Okay, got you. That's a given.
We play a little 888 sassy where you get a you. So when you have a 777 or 888, it means you have to have an 8 low, an 8 badoogie, or trip 8s or better to qualify on any side of the pot, and then it's sassy. So it's six card stud where after 6-3 you can pitch two or you can hold.
Okay.
But you have to pitch two if you pitch. So you can't try and draw into a flush or something. You have to pitch two cards or you have to pitch zero. So, you know, honestly, we played that one for the first time the other day and I was like, this is a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah.
Six card sassy with 888 qualifiers. And there's a community card out there anyone can use. So there's just like a one card flop out in the middle. And we play the dub. One day we played, actually, I have a good story. So, one day we played second best hold'em, limit hold'em at the end. You were trying to have the second best hand. Mm-hmm. You play limit or no limit. It was a weird game. Then we played third best. But here's how it works. If the pot gets heads up, you auto chop the pot.
Right. Okay.
So aggression gets really rewarded because if you get down a heads up, you both win. You're trying to have the third best hand at showdown.
Okay. Right.
So we have this hand where the flop comes king, queen, 10 or something like that. Checks all the way around. And I bet with just some low hand, 5-3, whatever it is. Call, guy jams. Okay, gets back to me. And now my hand is so bad that I want to bait people into calling. I'm gonna have the third. So if I get a three-way call, I'll have the worst. So I'll have the third best hand. So I'm like, oh God, what do I do here? I'm like, all the theatrics. I'm going into the full bag, right? my friend Jake is behind. I just want him to really want to call. And I finally call and he goes, okay. And he calls. I have 5-3 offsuit. He calls with pocket sixes. Pocket sixes. How is that ever going to be the worst hand here? And then the other guy has 6-4. I hit a five and he scoops our money. And I'm just like, idiot. And then Jake stands up and he's like, you have to earn it. You have to earn it. And I was like, what are you doing? He's like, you have to earn it. It's like, this guy's stacking both of our chips. Oh my God. It's fucking ridiculous, man.
That's like a three bet call the queen four off and like, yeah, said it was a good player or something like that.
It's honestly just like that. Phil would fit right in our weekly 2040 mix game, dealer's choice.
I've got one very fun poker story that I can tell you because I didn't have a story when you told your tornado story, but now I do. So the scene is, we're in the Commerce in LA. We're playing 5-10. Me, bunch of American guys. And there's one guy at the table that everyone seems to be like talking to. He was a black guy. And everyone's just having a great time. They're all chatting away to him and he's chatting back to them. And so there's a slight lull in the conversation and somebody else at the table asks me where I'm from. And I say, I'm from Scotland, but I grew up in Northern Ireland. And this guy who everyone is talking to is like, oh, I did a bit of work out there. Can you say County Armagh? And I said it for him a couple of times and he was absolutely loving it, big smile and stuff like that. And then there was a slight lull in the conversation again. And I said to the guy, you said you were working in Northern Ireland. What do you do? And the whole table is just like, oh, like this. And he's in the middle of a hand. He just very coolly goes, I'm an actor. And I was like, all right, okay. And it was Don Cheadle. And I had asked Don Cheadle what he does for a living at the poker table. And seven American guys just went, oh, for fuck's
sake.
Like that. Super embarrassing.
Dude, I have a not-so-cool Don Cheadle story.
Oh, tell me.
One time I tweeted something about, like, COVID or something where people need to just chill out. And it got a bunch of hate online and it had a bunch of quote takes and I click on one of them and it was Don Cheadle tweeting about me and said, it's idiots like this, referencing me, that are the reason why we have all these problems. And he's just laying it on me just on this COVID thread. I can't even.
That's amazing.
Oh my God.
That was really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I did for a living. But I knew who Don Cheadle was. It was the weirdest thing. Like I'd seen all his films and like I'd seen Flight and Ocean's 11 and shit. And then fucking asked him what he did for a living. I felt like a moron.
Shit happens.
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
Yeah, exactly.
It's probably refreshing for him. He's like, finally, someone that's not just, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Everyone was sucking up to him, and I was just like, what do you do for a living, buds? And he's like, yeah, I'm an actor. And I was like, all right. Oh, yes, you are an actor. I recognize you. Good times. Have you ever played with anyone super famous that's not a poker player?
Mm-mm. I don't think I've ever played with an athlete.
No.
Have I ever played with an actor? I don't think so.
I once played with Bruce Buffer, and I'm not a UFC kind of guy, so like I didn't know too much about him. And we played this pot, it was like $1,000, and I showed my hand, and he tapped the table and mucked his cards, and then the dealer pushed him the pot, and he started like chipping it into his stack, and then like 20 minutes later, I was like, hang on a second, that was my pot. And he gave it, like he was super chill about it, leaned over, fist bump, all that shit. Just talking all the shit about like how he was going to beat up Conor McGregor and stuff. Like that. I was absolutely loving it, but I was like, that's great, can I get my $1,000 back, please?
You know, he did a Upswing Poker ad for us once where he did the whole Bruce Buffer thing, but for an Upswing course that we had. Do you ever really? See this before?
Yeah. Oh, I haven't. Can I get a link?
That's really cool. I'm sure Brady's got the link somewhere. It was pretty great.
He was a lot of fun to play with. He had some really cool stories. I didn't know who he was talking about, but he had some really cool stories.
I don't think I've ever sat with anyone. So I've never played private games.
Okay.
So it's not any cool private game story that I would have really, but I'm sure I've sat with somebody at some point that's just not, I'm just not thinking of. But
I see the chat asking if I got the money back. He was a total gentleman about it. He was like, yeah, no problem. Sorry about that. It was a genuine error. It wasn't like Bruce Buffer needed Gazzy's $500 or whatever.
How did you not realize that the chips went the wrong way?
I was in awe of this man telling stories about Conor McGregor throwing stuff at a bus or something like that. I was like, he can tell a story. I was just like fascinated by it. Like I have no interest in USA and I was just super fascinated by it. But then I realized and he gave it to me, which was
nice.
Yeah.
All right, Gazzy. Thanks for coming on the pod. What do you got coming up in the near future here? Oh, sounds like vlogging.
Yeah, so I'm going to be persevering with the vlog. Hopefully get another episode out in the next couple of days. A bit of Upswing work, making a module transitioning from the four categories to a slightly more solver-based strategy. Spoken a lot about Mike with that. Getting it started this week. Really excited about that. And then off to America for a couple of months. Looking forward to the series. Will you be making an appearance in the series at all?
Probably not, but, you know, time will tell.
You got to fire the main, you know. It's.
Do you? Last time I fired the main, I punted off all my chips in early position with Queen Deuce suited.
I was going to say we can swap 1%, but maybe not. Never mind.
The problem is I just get too tilted and I just spaz out.
Yeah.
I don't think I have the discipline.
That's fair, to be honest. That is fair. On that note, I'll tell one last story before we go. We were talking about Phil Helmuth looking at one cards. I haven't told this story before, and it's probably not the best platform to tell it, but first time I played the main event, made day two, I was on the button. I had 14 big blinds, and the big blind hadn't yet shown up. And it's not the best story because I'd sold like 30 or 40% action. But I looked down at one card and it was an ace. And then it folded around to me and I was like, well, I'm going all in anyway. So I like shoved because the big blind wasn't there. And then the small blind like, went like deep into the tank. And then he folded. And obviously the other card was an ace. I probably would have just like min opened if I'd realized I had pocket aces. So it probably cost myself a little bit EV there. But I can't really say anything bad about Phil Helmuth because I did the exact same thing.
Gazzy, that sounds disgraceful.
It was a
disgrace to the game.
I felt kind of bad about that one, to be honest. But yeah, now everyone knows.
At least I actually thought you were going to jam a really bad ace and get stacked there. But you know,
this is probably worse, to be honest. Like just shoving pocket aces there for 14 mids with a dead big blind.
Yeah, maybe someone thinks you're light. Get called, double up, win the main. You're not on this podcast. No, I'm just kidding. Actually, no. We've got some main event winners on this pod. All right. If you guys want to check out Gazzy B's vlog, you can check it over on YouTube, Gazzy B 123. Also, if you want to learn poker from Gazzy on Upswing, he's in the lab. Does great work there. A fan favorite, I would say. So check it out over at Upswing Poker. And that's going to do it here today. Thank you for joining today's podcast. If you're new to the podcast, hit the subscribe button. We'll see you guys again soon. Thanks for tuning in.